Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. And we are live here in the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner. Today, I am super excited to have Ines Johnson on the show with us. We're here to talk about indie writing, publishing, telling great stories, finding the audience that is clamoring for you to release new books. Ines Johnson is a multi-six-figure author of Kissing Books. I love that tagline, Ines. That is so, it's so funny, but also so poignant. Ines is a lover of fairy tales, folklore, and mythology. Ines spends her days reimagining the stories of old in a modern world. She writes books where damsels cause the distress, princesses wield swords, and moms save the world. I love that so much. Ines, thank you for taking time out to join us on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Hank. It's so funny. You're not the first person to mention the multi-six figures. I'm like, where did I put that? Broadcast? Because I tell my friends all the time that I want to be a sugar baby and find a sugar daddy. And then once we get together, I'll be like, surprise! That's my dream.
You know, who am I to argue with a dream, right? You know, whatever makes you happy. Ines, for the folks who might not be familiar with you and your work, what types of books do you write?
All kissing books all the time. So I have two pen names. One pen name under my middle name, Shanae Johnson, writes clean and wholesome Hallmark type of books. And then Ines Johnson, I have a steamier side with Ines Johnson. So I write steamy paranormal romance, steamy fantasy romance, and steamy contemporary romance with a touch of magic. Like, I like to write fairy tales in modern day without any magic.
Okay, gotcha. Fairy tale. Right. And then do you also publish as N period S period Johnson?
I tried. My readers got so confused and the algorithms got so confused that... The reason that I have published as Shanae and Ines, mm-hmm. is those are two completely different audiences.
Gotcha.
But what I started to write with NS, my NS readers would have read too, and they were just confused. They were like, this is you, right? Or did someone pirating you? They were so confused.
Gotcha. Well, you know, I'm happy to hear that, because so often you hear people and they're like, you know, I've just done amazing things from the beginning and it's just built and built and built. And I love hearing that you know, someone had a bit of a false start on something and you try it, mm-hmm. and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't work the way you thought it would, and you back up and you try something else. That's real life, exactly, if I'm ever heard. Yeah. Yeah. So let's backtrack just a minute. I love to ask people this question when we're getting started. What is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or a storyteller? What lit the fire that got you on this path?
So I come from a family that is all about storytelling. My dad, okay. is a bass player, and he would tell stories with sound. And he literally explained it to me like, I'm telling a story with sound. My aunt, his youngest sister, has been on library board since probably I could walk, because I can remember walking to the library with her. So I have my mother, I can still remember her teaching me to spell my name and teaching my siblings to spell their names. And she made it into like a sing song. So there's always been storytelling in my life. But when I knew I wanted to be a writer, mm-hmm. because of my godmother. So my godmother, who the community that I grew up in, like My godmother was at the top of the community. You know how communities have signs? Well, sure. She was right behind the community sign, right? So you had to pass her house in order to go all the way down. I lived at all the way at the end of the street. Okay. So I can't see her, like, wave, how are you doing? And maybe I'd pass through her house and go through her back door to continue down to my house. And in her kitchen, where she had a pantry where you're supposed to keep canned goods, you know, boxes of pasta and cereal and all that, that was her Harlequin library. She had those thin little Harlequins from like 30, 40 years ago that were in the mail. And I was looking because I loved books. My dad told stories. My mother did sing song. My aunt walked us to the library and I was like, can I read these? And she said, sure. Oh, it's 12. I went through her books like a maniac, and I can still remember my favorite Harlequin of hers and deciding that I want to be a romance writer. And I wrote the story and I left a gap because in those times, Harlequins had one love scene. It was all the end of the book. And I wrote the story and I left a gap. I was 12, remember? And so then I went and I wrote the story all from my head, right? But the love scene, which was just waves crashing. They're in the bed. They take their clothes off and there's waves crashing. That's all you get.
Right.
And I didn't understand what that meant. So I went and I did one of those when you try to copy and you change the order of the words so that it's not really plagiarism.
Right, right.
I did that at 12 years old. That's the first air quotes book that I ever wrote.
I love it. You know, my grandmother, I remember this. She had a sister that was, she and this sister were very close, but they were maybe 2 years apart. And I think my aunt was 2 years younger than her. And they would visit each other at least once a month, but they lived about 100 miles apart. But either grandmother would go down and visit her or the aunt would come up and visit. And they read those Harlequin romances and they would have, you remember when the grocery store had paper bags? They would collect these books and every month they would have a paper bag full and they would swap. And it was so funny. I remember that being, an ever present, thing at my grandmother's house. So that's hilarious. And she made no qualms about, you know, this is what she loved and that anytime you have spare time, you should find a book that you love and go all in. And I appreciate that to this day. So from that early 12-year-old experience to now where you are, what gave you the impetus, the push, or the desire to chase that dream and to write a book seriously? And, you know, did what was the story that you said, you know what, this needs to go from my imagination to the world? What was it that pushed you from this is a hobby or this is, you know, something that is just in the back of my mind to now this is something I want to pursue professionally?
So like many burgeoning romance authors, I was discouraged from writing romance in high school, by my wonderful high school teacher, who I still talk to on Facebook. And I said, I told her, I was like, look what I'm doing now.
Right.
But I still knew I wanted to be in storytelling. So I did a circuitous route and I went into television. I was a screenwriter. I was a producer. I did children's television. I did National Geographic documentaries. I was still fueling and feeding that need to tell stories, but it wasn't until I sat down and read Twilight and I saw this story and I don't know what about Twilight made me think I could do this. Why didn't I do this? I could do this.
I've heard so many people with the same story, believe it or not.
Yeah. I remember holding someone's baby in my arm. We're at a bowling alley and I'm reading this book and I'm like, I could do this. And so the next day I picked up and I wrote by hand my very first book. I picked up a pen and I started to write that wonderful story, which was over 100,000 words on like 12 different POVs will never see the light of day. However, I wrote a book. I did it.
Yeah.
And, it was a hobby at the time. And I'm still a screenwriter. And I was like, I don't know if this could ever be a screenplay. This is a lot of money to produce because there were aliens and it was like cross-continental. It was everything. And there was magic. It was everything. And so I put that aside, but I got to the end. That was the thing. Most people don't get to the end. And I heard that.
Right.
I got to the end and then I learned about Nano. It took me years to write this first book. And then I learned about Nano, where you're supposed to write a book in a month. I was like, what? So I tried Nano and I wrote a book in a month. I think I got to 50,000 words and the story wasn't done because I remember finishing in December. I won Nano, but I finished the book in December. And then I put that book aside. I was like, "Ooh, I did it again." Because at the time, I was thinking about traditional publishing. I wanted to get published with Harlequin because that's who raised me, literally. And I had started to send out queries for this weird book. It was over 100,000 words was cross multi-genre. And no, surprisingly, no one even responded to me. They didn't even give me rejection letters. They just didn't even respond to me. And during that time, you know, Kindle had come out. They'd open up their platform for indie authors. And what had started to become popular, this was around 2010, 2013. What had started to become popular was serialized stories. Remember, I come from television. I understood how to serialize because that's what I did.
Sure.
Said, let me try this now. And I wrote a serialized story in three parts. I published it December. And I knew it was steamy. And so I knew I probably wasn't going to sell it. Definitely not to Harlequin. I published it in December of 2014. And that book made $100. It was 99 cents. Serialized, part one of three. And it made $100.
That's serious movement.
I was delighted.
Yeah.
Delighted. Published the next book. I can't remember how long in between. Maybe a month, maybe two. Published the third book, and then I was off with the races. So that was a long way to tell you that story, but
no, that,
off with the races then.
Yeah. So I remember those days when serialized was really, it was definitely a strategy to kind of launching into the, onto the store and getting some traction. I remember Hugh Howie with what's his book that's now on... Wool. Yes. Thank you. That was originally a serialized story. And, all the following that, you know, everybody was like, you know, I'm going to do it like you did. And that worked, you know, for a while and, you know, and then things change. Coming from the television world and, this world where, production and writing, what was there any, trepidation to indie publishing? Back in the day, you know, when Kindle came out and really opened the gates for anyone to publish, I remember all the talk back then, you know, being like down with the gatekeepers, you know, no one can tell you what, you know, should be published and what shouldn't. And that was absolutely right. But right before that, you know, self-publishing was really a dirty word, you know, because a lot of times it was pay to play and, you know, there's a lot of really shady stuff that went on and Amazon really leveled the playing field and took that stigma away. When you first got in, was there any of that kind of residual stigma that you had to fight against, or was it just kind of the, you know, the golden fields of, you know, poppies of publishing and, you know, everyone come on in, you know, what was that experience like?
I'm sure there was, but I came up in Romancelandia. So outside of Romancelandia, all you hear is negativity towards romance and people almost feeling that we should be ashamed of ourselves for talking about women's desires and women's pleasure in our books. And so I didn't see any point in having those conversations. So I pretty much stayed in Romancelandia. So I'm sure there were. But inside of Romancelandia, all I saw were women helping women. I saw women looking over your shoulder and saying, girl, what are you doing? Don't do it that way. Do it this way. Your readers are over here, or you need to change that blurb. Or we were not just pulling each other up. We were yanking each other up because we wanted these stories. We were all voracious readers and we wanted more stories.
Sure.
So I didn't, like I said, I'm not trying to be like rose colored glasses. I'm sure it was there. I just wasn't paying attention because there were so many other voices in my head and so many hands on me saying, we got you. You got us. You belong here. These are our people who want your stories. And it's still like that to this day.
And thank God for that. That's the community and the robustness of the prevailing attitudes that I feel like have always been around indie publishing, that, you know, it's not me versus Inés. It's me and Inés versus Facebook and versus Twitter and YouTube and Netflix and all the things vying for people's attention. The more people we get reading, the more it benefits all of us. And I think that's been a prevailing attitude all along in this Kindle revolution of indie publishing, for sure.
I don't know that it's versus anybody or any platform, because I know that we're so blessed and lucky with romance that our readers are on Facebook. Our readers were on Twitter. They are on TikTok. They are on YouTube. And so I watch other people, men and women included, using those platforms to shout about their books and to connect to readers. It just became another platform to either shout or to put content up there for readers to find.
Yeah. You said your first book was kind of all over the place when it comes to genre, or you know, maybe it tried to include all the things that you were interested in. You know, it's so funny because writers, you know, if someone writes romance, a lot of times that person who writes those romance in her reading, she may also love fantasy. She may love sci-fi. She may love thrillers. You know, but what you write doesn't necessarily include all the things that you love personally that you like to consume. So how did you figure out what your genre of choice was after that first one, where you realized, okay, I'm kind of all over the place here. How do I hone down to the thing that's going to be better for the market and be better to market? Because you kind of focused, in one thing. And then, like we talked earlier, you've got your different pen names where you focus on different things. I guess what I'm asking is, how do you decide which boat you're going to be in and how to focus on that when I know that your interests are so varied?
When I wrote my first book, I did not know what I was doing, except I was trying to yank a story that was inside of me out and put it on paper. I did not think about the audience. I was the audience. And so often with first books, it's an audience of one. And then we say, you want to read this?
Yeah, right.
And a lot of times people are like, no, you wrote that for you. You did not write it for me.
And but don't you want to read my book with fairy ponies and lightsabers?
No. And so it took me a while to understand what the market was.
Yeah.
That the market is just readers clustered together in different locations. And sometimes, you know, they wander over or they go visit another friend, meaning that there's some readers that cross over and then there's some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
So I sat down and I studied the market. And this is what I mean when I say I sat down and studied the market. I knew that I was only writing romance. I'm not really interested in anything else. That's all that holds my attention. So then once I knew that romance was my umbrella, I started to look at, well, what's underneath that umbrella? And that's where you start to see the subgenres of romance. So you could have paranormal romance. You could have contemporary romance, historical romance, science fiction romance. So there's a lot of subgenres underneath of romance. But then there are even subcategories under there. So you got paranormal romance. Well, there might be shifter romance. There might be witches and wizards romance. There might be demons or angel romance. So there's a lot of subgenres, subcategories under the subgenres.
Right.
And then you get into the tropes. So there might be, again, let's just stick with paranormal romance. So paranormal romance, maybe you're doing shifter romance. Well, is it an alpha werewolf that you're writing? There are specific tropes that go with that. Are you writing a megaverse? There's specific tropes that go with that. Are you writing a beta romance? Are you writing in a pack? Are you writing a lone wolf? So, and because I was such a voracious reader, and most romance authors are and or were, because sometimes we write so much we don't get to read. Because we are voracious readers, we started to see the patterns. Not everybody can articulate the patterns, but if you are a reader, you know it when you see it.
Right.
I like, because I'm a consummate student, I wanted to sit down and study it. I wanted to study the patterns and understand why that book did so well and that book didn't do so well. And then if you start to read the reviews, you will keep seeing the patterns. Oh my God, I loved how this was a shifter romance and it had the alpha was so growly and he growled that she was his and he kidnapped her. And then he felt bad. And so he introduced her to his family and the family took her in and became family. And then he bit her. And you could go on and you could keep finding that in the reviews of what they loved. That's the patterns. Those are the trends. That is what the market is telling you. So if I decided to instead write a squirrel shifter who wanted to hoard all of the nuts that he found for winter, I didn't want to come out in the spring, people wouldn't work out. Nobody's asking for that. So it might be the book of your heart because you love squirrels, but nobody's asking you for it. So when you take it to market, you're not going to find anybody who wants to buy that, but everybody's going to be huddled around that shifter alpha romance.
Yeah. You were talking about that first book and how a lot of times that first book that people write is kind of a regurgitation, for lack of a better term, of all the things that we love. And we have so much to say. And a lot of times it's something that we're saying for us or to us. And, you know, a lot of people's first book is kind of self-therapy and working through issues. And you kind of have to get that out of the way. There's an argument that I hear, and argument's probably a strong word, but something that a lot of first-time authors especially deal with, I think, is the divide between, or at least what a lot of new authors perceive as the chasm between art and commerce. And everybody becomes a writer because they feel like they have something to say. I've got a story I want to tell and it's going to be impactful. And, you know, someone's going to read this book and they're going to close that back cover and their life is going to be changed, you know, for, you know, the high and lofty goals, I think. But that's what a lot of people get into writing for. They feel like they have something to say. But then, you know, you've published 2, 3, 4 books and you start realizing, well, this is also a business. If I want people to read my work and I want them to have a life-changing experience, then it has to get to them. And there's some business involved in getting my books into the hands of readers. And, you know, the line between art and commerce gets real blurry there because, it can be a definite work of art, but if you can't sell that work of art to someone, it's not going to have any impact. So was there ever a time for you where you realized, kind of the dichotomy, at least it feels like a dichotomy of art versus commerce? And if so, how did you learn to embrace that and say, you know, that I'm a businesswoman and, you know, if I want people to read my stories, I also have to care about the business side and not just be a glorious artist?
You first have to understand that both answers are completely valid. If you want to get into this for the art of it, that is beautiful. Do it. If you want to get into this for the commerce side to make your books take care of you, do it. And some people come in just for commerce. And that's great. I am not mad at you. I'm not mad at either of you.
Right.
But remember, even though I do make multi six figures, I still want to be a sugar baby. I don't want it because I don't want to take care of someone else. I want us to take care of each other. When I got into this industry, the first book that I wrote, that first book, it was complete art. It was art. There were some beautiful sentences in that book that made no sense, but they were beautiful sentences. And then my first year, I knew I was a romance author and I just wrote whatever I wanted to, but it was all romance. But one book would do good. And then I write something. So the first book that I wrote was like a dystopian romance and made $100 that first month. Right.
Hey.
After that series was done, I wrote a contemporary romance, which did good. But when people went to look at my backlist, they were like, huh? Wait, what is this? Dystopian? And then the next book I wrote was a werewolf shifter. And people were completely confused. So I was building three different audiences. That's the first thing. So when I started to understand the market and when I started to understand the money that could be made, it's when I took a look at those three different products and I said, you're going to need to streamline this because you keep building these different, you know, in this industry, just like I can't read a bully romance. I can't. I've tried to read mafia romance. Mafia romance right now is hugely popular. I can't get past act one. Because the guy starts being mean to the girl or he kidnaps her. Or I'm just like, no, he has to love her. So I started to see that that's when I started to see these clumps. Now I could still, there are absolutely people who defy everything that I'm talking about. They defy genre expectations. They defy tropes. They defy everything. And they make it work. They are far and few between. You could count them. There's thousands, hundreds of thousands of people writing, and a lot of them are doing well enough that this can sustain them. And what they're doing is they're not just thinking about book of my heart. They're thinking about their purse strings. And I think about my purse strings. I make it so that I look at the market. And when I say I look at the market, I go look at the Amazon top one. I don't look at the New York Times. That's completely pay to play. I look at the top 100 of Amazon. I look at the top 100 of Barnes & Noble Nook. I look at the top 100 of Apple. And I see what the market is doing because the market are readers putting their money where their mouth is and buying the books. You cannot game that. You have to, if someone is buying your book, that's what's ticking you up higher on all of those bestseller charts. And if you look, a lot of times you're not going to see what is selling on those top 100s or not what's on the New York Times or the USA Today bestsellers list. They're different because those retailers, they're all about the money. They want to give you what's going to sell. So what I do, and I am answering your question in a roundabout way.
No, that's fine.
I figured out that if I know that I want to write romance and I see that mafia romance is really popular, well, at the basis of mafia romance, it's really enemies to lovers, opposites attract. It's that trope that I understand. So how can I take that trope and then present it to readers to say, hey, this is what you want. It doesn't go as extreme as mafia, because I know that there's readers out there like me who like the enemies to lover but don't want her to get kidnapped.
Yeah.
So
my feeling.
Right. So yeah. I look at what I like to write. I look at what the market is doing and I find the overlap there. And that is where I make my money, hitting that overlap hard, because there's such a thing as burnout. If you keep doing things just for the market, you're going to get tired. You're going to see real quick that this passion, this hobby that you had is going to turn into the job from hell, because you have to do it now. You have to write the book. You have to write to market. And I don't think that that's sustainable. I think what is sustainable is what I just said, looking at the market and finding where your passion is somewhere in that top 100 chart, because that's telling you a reader wants to read that particular book, but then you do it your way. You find the patterns of what's selling. Again, with mafia romance, we like a dominant male in a mafia romance. We like that they might not have things in common at first, and then they slowly see that they do, or that they have each other's back, or that they get put in tight situations and they have to work together. That's what we like. We like that dance, but not so hard. So that's what you start to do. If you see that, what else is doing? Fourth Wing is doing really great right now. That's forbidden romance. It's opposites attract. It's dragons. It's paranormal. So you take the things from those top three subgenres right there, and you pull from it what's working for Fourth Wing, and then you put your stamp on that.
Love it. Love it. And when on the surface, if you haven't really thought about it, you think, well, do people really want books with the same tropes over and over? And I'll give you a very, they do. You're 100% right. But I'll give you a very specific example for me as a reader. There's a certain author who is from my home state that I've been a huge fan of for a couple of decades. And he wrote some brilliant books 20 years ago. And I keep wanting to re-experience what I felt when I first read those books. And so I will keep buying his new releases, even though it's felt like he's kind of phoned it in for the last five or six books. And I keep buying them anyway because of the feelings that he gave me, you know, two decades ago.
That's why we keep going to McDonald's.
Thank you. It's, you know, and no, I don't want to read the same book twice because they're sitting on my shelf. I could go read those, but I want him to tell me a story that's in the same vein, but different.
And Same, but different.
Your explanation of your answer to my question was perfect. Absolutely right. You have a brilliant YouTube channel, and we'll put links in the show notes where people can go find it. But a couple of videos that you made that I really loved, I was watching a couple of days ago. You made one where you were, I'm trying to remember the title of it, and you'll just have to help me. You were laying out kind of your writing schedule and publishing schedule for the upcoming quarter or year. And you had this wall. It looked like a mirror wall, and you had sticky notes all over it. Wow. And I love that so much. But one thing you said in there really intrigued me. You said, there's a book coming out soon, and I forget what it was. It was a vampire book, I think, if I remember right. And you said, this will be coming out and people will want more of this. So because I have done some market research and I know that this is coming out, I need to move this book of mine up in the production schedule so that I can try to meet the need that will be there, that this has stoked. And I thought that was a brilliant way to look at market research, as to just understanding what's out there, what anticipating what readers are going to relate to, and then having something there to offer them. You know, if you like this, then I have a new release also. And I think that's a brilliant way to think of market research.
It was because I was looking at the pre-orders. So the book that I was writing previous to the vampire book was not doing as well as I had hoped.
Okay.
And then I had this vampire book on pre-order. I saw the pre-orders were doing really well, selling more than the other book. So some people are completionists. I'm a completionist. I have some series that are still on my Kanban board, is what you were looking at. I have some series that are still on my Kanban board, which is a productivity board. And I can't take them off. Those series are not selling. They're not doing well. And I can't take them off the board because in my brain, even though nobody is asking me for them, I still have to finish them. But I will not let myself finish them right now because they're not doing well. So they're still just sitting there because the completionist in me will not take it down.
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to a follow-up question to that. Is there ever a time where there's a series that's maybe not doing well right now, but maybe the market will change? And if it changes in that direction, you have something in your backlist already that you could you know, feed that desire for, to, you know, as a working author and publisher, do you think in those kinds of terms that, you know, it, maybe it's not having a moment right now, but when it does, I've got product ready for it.
So the market shifts and the market is cyclical. So I started writing some dragon books maybe 4 years ago. I can't remember exactly. And they just weren't doing, I thought that they were going to be great. The dragons were hot at the time. It was when Stranger Things first came out. And there was a lot of this 80s nostalgia in my, in the world that was happening. But I put the 80s nostalgia in my books because my dragons were like kind of trapped in time. They lived like beyond a realm. And they hadn't come back over to across the realm since 1980. So there was a ton of 80s nostalgia in my books, and dragons and sassy heroines. I had everything in this book, and it just, it did not hit well when I originally wrote them in like 4 years ago. Yeah. Fast forward a couple of years later, I put the books on sale. Maybe I put the first book on sale. I don't remember. And it was time. They came back around and they started to make money again. So the market shifts and the market is cyclical. A lot of people are in romance are having a great time with hockey romance. All of a sudden, hockey romance just went crazy because of TikTok, of course. And so people who had written hockey books like 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, all of a sudden their books that are 8 years old are back in the top sellers because now there's always a new surge of readers. Always. There are readers being born every day. Right. So you're going to catch them. You just have to be ready. I make most of my money off of my backlist, not my frontlist.
Interesting.
Because I'm always marketing my backlist. Always, 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 always. Because I know that there's a new reader. And then once they get into, like, for example, the dragon book, well, I wrote 6 of those dragon books. And then at the end of, if you get to the 6th, I'm funneling you from book 1 to all the way to book 6. If you get to the end of book 6, then I tell you, oh, you love these dragons? Well, I also have werewolves. And then I send you to the werewolves, and then you get to the end of the werewolves. Oh, did you like this, that also had a dystopian world? Oh, did you like this dystopian world? Wait till you read my very first book ever, which is also dystopian. So I keep you going. Once I get you in to my funnel, I will not let you go ever. So it doesn't matter if you come into a new release from me, because people like the new shiny, or if you go and come in from the backlist, because that's new to somebody else. I keep you funneled. I keep you going.
I love it. Another YouTube video that I saw that you post, you referenced the Kaylytics report. Mm-hmm. And Alex Newton, the guy that does Kaylytics, has been on the show with us. He's a great friend of ours. Wonderful, wonderful guy that does the Lord's work in research for indie authors. But tools like Kaylytics, has that... Because you've been producing and selling books for longer than the Kaylytics has been around, I'm pretty sure. What other tools like Kaylytics are helping you to make sure that you're on target with what you're writing and your marketing? Like, are there things like that that are kind of in your toolkit these days?
Not really. I do know that another great tool for people to use would be like Katie Publisher Rocket. That would be another great tool.
Yeah.
There's an email that comes out. I can't remember, Kindle Trends or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but I do it the old fashioned way. Well, I do use the app. So on my cell phone, I have the app. So I have the Amazon app. I have the Barnes and Noble Nook app. I have the iBook app, the Google Play app. And so I'll just go on the apps. I'll tap the apps and I'll look at the top 100. Just, you know, as I'm waiting in a grocery store line, I'll look and see what's happening. That's how I knew with my sweet, clean, wholesome pen name, Shanae Johnson. That's how I knew that it was a good bet for me to write Cowboys. Because I kept seeing, no matter what platform that I was on, especially on Barnes & Noble, that Cowboys were just constantly in the top 100.
Yeah.
Steamy Cowboys with their shirts off. Clean and Wholesome Cowboys with their shirts all the way buttoned up. Cowboys, Cowboys, Cowboys.
Right.
And so that's how I made that decision, by just standing in the grocery store line, waiting for my oatmeal to heat up in the morning, and I tapped the apps, and that's what I saw.
Gotcha. Gotcha. So from doing this for more than a decade now, And you know, really getting into the groove of having a publishing business. What does your daily work life look like now? And how do you split your time between creating and writing versus all of the, you know, when you have to switch hats and put your publisher businesswoman hat on? What's a typical day of production look like for you?
So I'm a morning bird, an early bird, and I get up and I do the miracle morning. If you've ever heard of how Elrod's, he calls them the savers. And you can go and Google this stuff and find it, but I get up and I do my savers around 6 o'clock in the morning. And then I just kind of just do self-care because it is so easy to be sedentary. It is so easy. This is such a solitary career.
Right.
Just get in your own head. It's so easy to just do all of that. So I get up and I do my self-care. Then at 8 o'clock in the morning, Monday through Thursday, I'm in this seat and I'm writing. I write from 8 a.m. until about 11:30 a.m. You cannot bother me. You cannot call unless you're my dad. Or right now, both of my kids are home. My kids are in their 20s, but they're both home right now. I will not answer the phone. I'm not going to talk to you. Don't even try it. It's my writing time. It is sacred. And by 11, I'm tired. My brain is tired and it needs to do something else. So I go, I eat and or take a walk or go out to eat if I need to treat myself. And then when I come back, that's when I start to do my admin. And it can be anything. I may be like, everything is checked off my list right now. I'm done. But today, I usually work on two manuscripts. But today I revised two chapters of one book. And then I fast drafted four chapters of another book. And when I say fast, I mean, I vomited on the page because my brain needs to just see the words on there because I know I can come back and I can
write.
So I did that between 8 and probably noon when I got hungry.
Okay.
I sat on the couch because I needed a scene change. So I went in my living room and I sat on a couch and I started to play with the plot of the story that I'll be writing next month. So I like having my finger in some form of the process at all times. So I was revising a story that I wrote last month. I'm drafting the new story for that I'm currently working on, and I'm thinking about the plot of the next story, just slowly, just really slowly. I'm methodical in that. Like, people think I'm so fast, but it's because I'm methodical and consistent and disciplined to do it almost every day. And then before I got on with you, I was doing some professional development. I want to grow my Instagram. So I was watching some videos on growth techniques on Instagram. I did that for maybe 30 minutes. And then I had a little bit of time left over to do the very last thing on my list, which was to do some other business development stuff, some business admin stuff, just jotting down some quick notes that I think is enough and I don't have to go back to it after I finish talking to you today. That's my day. Sometimes the admin will last longer. Like today, it would have lasted longer, but I'm about to be talked out after we talk, and I'm just going to want to sit down and stare at my navel. But if I hadn't been talking to you, I would be doing more admin until about 3-ish, where I try to engage, talk to other people, talk to those things called friends.
Right, right.
Maybe go outside, get some fresh air, go for a walk, go to the gym. Whatever. I try to do something else because come 6 o'clock, I'm done. I'm ready to stare at my navel again until it's bedtime.
I love it.
Okay. Well, that's Monday through Thursday. And then on Friday is admin all day because I need to take a day where I am just, it feels really good to come to the admin. I'm not writing anything new. I don't have to be creative with my words. I love to then move that creativity over to the other side of my brain. I make my ads. I do my newsletters. I do social media posting. I start to think about what new marketing techniques I need for whatever book or book series that I'm promoting for that month. So that's all of Friday.
I love it. And I love that you have your systems down and I love it. One last question before I let you go, Ines. Can you tell me about Ines Johnson Breaks It Down?
So Ines Johnson Is Having a Breakdown is my podcast. I have two podcasts. That one, I started during COVID and I just wanted to talk to people. I'm a complete introvert, but I like explaining things. So I started to just talk about, because I started also doing a lot of presentations at like RWA's, Inkers Con, NINC, 20 Books, like all those kind of conferences. And I started explaining things, and a lot of these things that moved to Zoom. And so I just took a couple of minutes and I would explain something, like the last one that I did that came out, what's today, Wednesday, that came out yesterday. What did I do yesterday? Yesterday, it was all about, I started studying romantic comedies. So I became fascinated with how do you make these books funny? Like, what are you doing to make these books funny? And there's a Robert Haig, Michael Haig, I want to call him Robert. Michael Haig talks about how romantic comedies are all about deceptions and revelations. But that's kind of, that's pretty much all that he gave us. And I was like, well, what kind of deceptions are there? So I sat down and I watched, I don't even remember how many romantic comedies, to figure out what kind of deceptions were they. And I broke them down into four. So these are the kind of things that I break down. Like, I broke down what rom-com deceptions are. I broke down, I'm fascinated with Blake Snyder and the Save the Cat method.
Yep.
And what I fail at every time with that method is a 5-part finale. So I broke down. Oh, you're pulling the book off the shelf. Yeah, right.
Jessica Brody's, you know, the Save the Cat writes a novel, but
yeah. So, but I'm a trained screenwriter, so I was looking at the screenwriter's guide, right. And he talks about the 5-part finale, and I suck at the 5-part finale, and I was like, I'm going to conquer this. And so nobody does the 5-part finale better than Marvel, and so I watched 5 Marvel movies and I broke down the 5-part finale of each. And so in the podcast, I go through them all. I talk about the 5-part finale of Thor, the 5-part finale of Black Panther. So that's what I'm doing in this podcast, is I'm taking a look at some type of craft element and I'm breaking it down step by step and telling people about it.
Love it. I love it. Inés, you are a gift to the writing community. And I'm so thankful that you came on the show today to open your brain. If people are just discovering you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you're up to, where's a good place for them to look you up and find you?
The best place to take a look, if you are an author, is ineswrites.com/PTP for page turner pacing. That's where you can find the podcast, the courses that I run. I give a lot of free content on places like Substack. I have a authored newsletter where I just break things down, just because I was like, how does that work? And then I sit down and figure out how it works. Then I tell other people, because they say that that's the best way to make sure you've learned something, is to explain it to another person. If you're interested in my books, you can go to ineswrites.com. Or if you want the sweeter stuff, you can go to shanaejohnson.com.
Love it. We'll link up all that stuff in the show notes, and we'll put your Amazon pages as well, and your YouTube and your podcast. If you're making pot holders by then, we'll find a link.
You laugh, but I've got a crochet needle over in the corner because that's my self-care.
See, I fully anticipated that to be your answer. So, Inés, thank you so much for taking time to join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.